Yeah.
We're definitely at an exciting time for medicine, for mankind, and technology. I'd like to go ahead and cue this up, and we can get started. Guys, this is the Merge Medical Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jeff Brown. I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Jeff Cole, and Dr. Robert Pearl. We are so delighted to have Dr. Pearl with us today. He is the author of ChatGPT MD. He's on the Forbes Healthcare, he is a Forbes Healthcare contributor on the faculty at Stanford. He's also a podcast host himself and the former CEO of Kaiser Permanente. Dr. Pearl, thank you so very much for joining us. I'd love to talk about your book. We're going to try to squeeze probably 10 days of material into about an hour long conversation with you. We're super glad you're here. Dr. Pearl, thank you.
Hey, Jeff and Jeff, it's great to be here. The book is doing well. It's already number one on Amazon's best new books list. And all profits from the book go to Doctors Without Borders. And there's additional information for listeners on my website, robertpearlmd.com. Let's get going.
That's awesome. And we should remind the viewers, we can put a QR code or a link to your book and emphasize the fact that the profits all go towards a very good organization that does a lot of good around the world, supporting Doctors Without Borders. So you were telling us offline that the ChatGPT actually helped you write the book. Tell us about that.
This whole effort was, I'll call it an experiment. What I could see was that generative AI, and I use ChatGPT because it flows nicely, and GPT then goes to MD, but it's really all the generative AI tools, Gemini and Claude and a variety of others. It's an experiment because we're at the dawn, at the onset of what will be a next era in medicine. We've got to learn. So I thought it'd be interesting to have ChatGPT be a co-author. There's a lot of writers who are using it as a source of information, but I went beyond that. I downloaded the 1.2 million words that I had published and probably went back and forth 200-300 times per chapter in order to be able to maximize the conversation as one would with a co-author who's a human instead of a AI application. And so that's the process that I did. It also sped up the publication. The whole work took about 6 months. I'm not sure that it took any less effort and energy, but it allowed me to short circuit the completion of the book to the printing, to the distribution, and to making it available. And it's available now, as we said earlier, on Amazon.
So you said it functions more like an adjunct or an assistant. Do you think that this is the way, at least in the midterm, that physicians will use artificial intelligence?
Well, first of all, I want to separate out. We use the word artificial intelligence. I think we should stop using that as the singular, actually two letters, AI, mm-hmm. for all of the tools that are now available. They're very, very different. And in ChatGPT MD, I talk about that. I start 1980 to 2000, we had rule-based AI. This was information put in by computer programmers and by clinicians about how to approach a problem. It's the way all of us learned in medical school. It's an algorithm. You start with a patient with a cough and you say, is there a fever or not a fever? If there's a fever, you then want to know if the phlegm is discolored, and it takes you down the pathway. Is it viral? Is it fungal? Is it bacterial? This is the way that we go, and that's how it's programmed. The problem with a rule-based AI is that it can never be any better than the people who designed it. And as you know, in medicine, we learn heuristics, these shortcuts. And heuristics are benefited by the human brain. And obviously, the application doesn't have a human brain. So we needed a next level. And around 2000, we saw that. This was the use actually of a biological concept of neural networks, just the way our brain is structured, and within all that deep learning. And what it does is it takes two data sets, like 10,000 mammograms, half of which show cancer, half of which are normal or have benign disease, and it finds 50 rules, 50 differences in these two data sets, and it puts probability around each of them. And what we know is that already it's about 10% better than radiologists. But it's only specific to mammograms. You want to do chest x-rays? You need new data sets. Brain scans, new data sets. You go on down the line, we need 10,000 of these. So far, there's about 400 approved by the FDA. Come 2 years ago, OpenAI releases what is used called generative AI. GPT is nice because it's the P stands for pre-trained. Has all of the information from the internet, every medical textbook, every journal article downloaded into it. Then the T is for transforming. It provides parameters, actually over a billion of them. Should it use journals that are more recent or older ones? Obviously more recent ones. Peer-reviewed over non-peer-reviewed. Ones coming out of major academic institutions over ones that are coming from some unreliable source. And then G is the generation of that. So that's how we have to think about this. I believe that we need to truly expand our thoughts about the future. Let me make one point for your listeners and viewers, that what exists today is not what we're just talking about. Generative AI is doubling in power exponentially, doubling in power every year. 5 years from now, it's gonna be 30 times more powerful. It's like your car going as fast as an airplane 5 years from now. I'm looking in the 3 to 5 year range. And then we can talk in some great detail about how we might use it. But the key part is going to be doctors being willing to empower patients. You guys are going to be seeing a patient with a particular problem. Rather than starting in the office, an exam room, have the patient become educated about that. If they have a chronic disease, link it with their wearable monitors and provide information to them every day so that rather than waiting 3 to 4 months to see a patient back, we actually can make changes in medication on a monthly basis. Let's go into a lot more detail on this conversation today, but it's a whole different way to approach American medicine.
I don't know if am I supposed to be scared from that or excited?
I think you should be really excited. I don't know about you personally, but you as a clinician, why do I say that? Well, first of all, we know that 60% of physicians are burned out today. And when you ask yourself why, I think the answer is because the amount of work that we have today is more than we can do. And why do I say that? It's really the introduction of chronic disease, which, as you know, has become an epidemic. And the difference is if you go back to the last century, most patients had acute problems, appendicitis, a broken bone, pneumonia. And when you have those problems, you provide care for a short time period, and then there's no need to see the patient again under most circumstances. You have chronic disease, I've got to see you 3-4 times a year, every year for the rest of your life. You start to have the fact that 60% of Americans have a chronic disease. 75% of people on Medicare have 2 or more chronic diseases. We've overwhelmed the medical profession. And so to the extent that you are impeded by the medical culture, which makes it difficult for us to want to collaborate and to share power with patients, that's just the history, nothing personal about it, just the way medicine evolved and how we were trained, yeah, it could be scary. But on the other hand, if you say, my gosh, I got so much more to do today than I can, how do I increase patient outcomes and create the time that I need to reinforce the doctor-patient relationship? How do I go home at night feeling as though I did a really good job and really help my patients to become healthier? I think then you'd be really optimistic. And I'll offer one other piece, which is that if you look at what's about to happen in American medicine, the projections by the federal government is that healthcare is going to go up in cost $3 trillion a year by 2031. That's 7 years from now. Ask yourself, how are the insurers going to respond? How is the government going to respond? What we're going to see is massive downward pressure. We already saw it this year with the Medicare rates being shrunk. We're going to see it out of insurers. That's not the world I want to be in as a clinician. I want to have greater freedom to help my patients get better. And I think generative AI will be the tool to accomplish it.
Don't you think I feel like the system is on its way to breaking because if you say that healthcare is going to increase by that much and United Health Group had either profits or gross revenues over $97 billion last fourth quarter of 23. They're like, bring it on. We'd love to have several more trillion coming to us.
Well, you're absolutely right.
Cost is not the same thing as profit, though, right? Because Dr. Pearl's saying that this is however many trillions in cost, that doesn't necessarily transfer to profits to the bottom line, right?
Well, I think the large institutions will always find the way to make the profits. The large hospital systems, as Jeff said, the insurance companies, I don't really worry about them. You look at the profit increases of the largest insurers that came out last week, it was twice as fast as the overall S&P, and the S&P went up significantly over the past several years. I don't worry about their ability to make profit, but you're absolutely right. They need to have not just the bottom line increase, but the top line, the revenue line increase in order to generate that bottom line. And so I think that they aren't unhappy with the current system. The people who are getting squashed are the clinicians providing the care, and I'll say some of the smaller independent hospitals trying to do the best they can for the communities that they serve. They just don't have the power to fight back. It's an unfair battle. And generative AI, to me, now creates that possibility. But let's, you know, you've really delved into a really important area. How might it happen? Because this is also important for the clinicians listening in to understand, which is that you can't just go to generative AI. And a generative AI tool, let's assume that we're really good at it. Let's assume, and I think the data would say we probably could accomplish it. We can lower the chances of patients having chronic disease 30 to 40% and improve the management, the control, so that the complications, and we're talking about heart attacks, strokes, cancer, kidney failure, amputation for diabetic peripheral disease. Let's assume that we can reduce these by 30 to 40%. What would happen? Well, first of all, the health of people would go up dramatically. If I'm a patient, I don't want my heart attack to be reversed. I want to prevent it in the first place. So the patient does well. The cost goes down dramatically. 30 to 40% fewer heart attacks and strokes and cancer, kidney failure, and peripheral amputations. That would be a dramatic diminution in the costs that are spent. But wait a second, because if they go down in a fee-for-service system, in the transactional way that we reimburse clinicians, the more you do, the more you get paid, whether it does any good or not, doesn't really matter in terms of the reimbursement system, then we have a problem because clinicians already, and I don't want to say they're struggling, it's hard to say that to the audience when the doctors make a moderate amount of income, but compared to what they need, compared to what they expected, in the context of 10 years of training and $200,000 of debt, yes, a 30% decrease in income would be very problematic for them and their family. So when I look at all of that, what I say is that we need a different solution. And that to me means we have to shift reimbursement from simply being transactional to focusing on the opportunities to reward value, called value-based care, prepayment, pay for value. I like capitation. The idea of creating a certain amount of dollars to a group of clinicians who collaborate and cooperate, who emphasize prevention, disease management, patient safety, all the things that we know we should be doing, and get paid on this capitated basis. Now it all makes sense. Because if we reduce those problems by 30 to 40%, we can actually earn additional income while reducing the cost to the patient as well as the payer, who often is a business or the government.
So true healthcare rather than sick care, which is what we're doing now.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Primary care physicians, do you see them benefiting with the right tool set and becoming more healthcare providers than sick care providers, or just referring patients upstream to the big systems for more expensive care?
Absolutely. I mean, we know that we have a crisis in primary care in this country. We know that the amount of dollars that we invest in primary care continues to shrink. It's now between 5 and 5.5% of the country spend about double that. We know the data from two studies done by Harvard and Stanford that adding 10 primary care physicians to a community increases longevity 2.5 times more than adding 10 specialists. I'm a specialist. It's not that I don't think that it's important. It's that it's not the foundation. The foundation is going to be inside primary care. So I think this is a way to do it. But as I wanted to point it out earlier, unless we also move the payment methodology to one that reimburses and values clinical outcomes, prevention of disease, increased health, better disease management, fewer complications, greater patient safety. Unless we do those things, then we are not able to reimburse primary care. And so that's the shift that has to happen. I don't think it will dramatically erode income for specialists. That's not going to be the outcome. And that, by the way, is what exists today in a situation where either I win or you win. It's a win-lose situation. Keeping patients healthier allows the possibility of both rewarding primary care and rewarding the specialists. Who's going to pay the price? Well, hospitals will pay some degree of price. But my belief is that we have too many hospitals and hospital beds. Not that we don't fill them today, but the fact is we have people in them who don't need to be in them. They should have had that problem in the first place, or maybe they should be able to be taken care of by a hospital at home. I mean, let's just look at how generative AI can change all of these pieces. 11 o'clock at night, your child has 102 fever. What do? Assuming you're not a clinician. Well, you could go to the ER where you know you'll wait an hour or two. You'll be surrounded by people coughing with infectious disease. We'll wait till the morning. But what about if it's meningitis? What do you do? You call your doctor's office, and what do you get? A recorded announcement. Go to the ER. Well, that's not an answer. You want to know what you should do. You know that announcement is only because it protects the clinician. You call the answering service. They say the doctor will call you back in the morning. You don't want it in the morning. You want it right there and then. We have nothing right now to offer to patients. You go to Google and you click on links, you get a lot of information that you're not quite sure if you can trust it, but it doesn't really tell you what to do about your kid. Generative AI is personalized. It solves it. You have chronic diseases. You have monitors. We can monitor blood pressure, pulse, blood oxygen, blood glucose. And the problem is you get a lot of numbers and you don't know what to do with it. And does your clinician want all this in his or her electronic health record? Absolutely not. Do they have a time to look at all the blood glucose numbers and blood pressure monitoring numbers? No. How about hospital at home? We know 30% of people in a hospital would do better at home in an environment where they actually can sleep, not surrounded by noise and by light all the time, minimize the risk of a medical error. And these are things we can't do because you want to be able to monitor the patient, and you're not going to be able to afford to have doctors and nurses watching it all the time. These are just a few of the ways that we can take what is now a broken health system, as you pointed out, from the last century and move it forward rapidly into the current one.
So, Dr. Pearl, do you feel like it's biomarkers and other predictive data points feeding to system-specific monitors, whether it's heart, lung, GI, feeding that data into an AI solution and really pointing the physician group monitoring this? What's the problem? What's the predictive value? Is that kind of how this all happens? Is that where AI gets involved in analyzing that data once it's come through a monitoring device?
Well, there's a huge amount of information. Some is put in by the patient. The patient could be putting information. Within a year or so, we're going to have not just typing into the generative AI tools, but actually voice conversation back and forth. The technology exists. It's just not high enough yet in the priority of the manufacturers. So there's a huge amount of data. We know the human genome. We can sequence it at a relatively low cost. What we don't have is a way to handle all the data. We know that the medical literature is doubling every 72 days. How can the human mind comprehend that amount of information, no less access it?
That's right.
A data overload, and as a consequence of that, we underuse, underimplement the information that is available. So the generative AI tool is one that allows that to happen. But we have to put it into the context, I believe, of the doctor-patient relationship. To me, a dedicated clinician with an empowered patient and generative AI tool is going to be far better than any one of the three alone. That triad is really the future. And what we have to create, and why I'm so excited, or what really why I started to write the book, and what I'm so excited about the future, is this is just the dawn. To me, it's the iPhone in 2007. How are we going to use a new technology? We didn't have any sense that we'd actually be directing our cars through Waze and Maps using this tool back when it came out. We didn't have any sense of the ability to do all the retail purchasing, have goods delivered to your door the next morning using this tool sitting in place. Social media barely existed at that particular time. This is the same point that we are. And again, I'll stress for listeners and viewers, what exists today is not what we should be relying on. Today, this technology requires human oversight. But I'll give you a really interesting example to me of the power that is now possible when you empower a patient. I said earlier, I've been on 23 podcasts this week and last week and this week. One of the early ones I did on Monday, I spoke to a interviewer. At the end of the show, she said to me, Dr. Pearl, you're a skier and you're a clinician. My husband about 2 months ago fell down. His arm was extended over his head. And ever since then, his shoulders really hurt him and he can't use it the way he used to before. What's going on? What do you think is happening? And I said, you know, I think I know exactly what he has, but why don't you take the information, put it into a generative AI application. You can use ChatGPT 3.5, which is a free application if you want, although GPT-4 is better, and see what you find out. I got an email a couple of days later. She said, thank you so much for making that suggestion. And she told me the diagnosis, and it was the one that I thought that it would have been. She told me the recommended diagnostic test that the generative AI tool had come up with, and that's the one that was most appropriate. And it said something really interesting. It said surgery is usually required for this problem. And she contacted an orthopedic surgeon who diagnosed the torn rotator cuff, ordered the MRI, and said, if you had not come in now, and we'd waited 2, 3, 4 more months, that muscle might have contracted and I might not have been able to reattach it appropriately. That is the empowered patient. It didn't solve her problem, but it gave her the expertise she needed to know to better contact someone soon. And in contacting someone soon, was able to get the appropriate treatment. And I'm going to guess that her husband will get a really great outcome as a consequence.
Oh, it's, hey, where's, so I can easily see a system a few years from now that is as smart, much, actually smarter than a clinician, that would do the thinking for you, if that's the right term. Where's the liability in that?
That is such a common question. It's probably one of the most interesting ones. And I'm actually doing a lot of research on that topic right now, planning to write about it. And the challenge is that there is no case law right now that tells us exactly that. So I'll offer some thoughts with the caveat that I'm not an attorney.
Right.
At this point, I've now spoken to quite a number of them. There seem to be two different paths, I'll call it that. There are companies that will produce bots. NVIDIA, the large chip manufacturer, last week announced a nurse AI bot. The nurse AI bot, by the way, in the data they reported, has not been peer reviewed, appears to be significantly better than humans, than the nurses who would normally provide the answers at getting it correct. Not 100%, but significantly better than the humans. When you create a bot selling that product, I suspect the liability will be with the manufacturer. It's why so few companies have done so. For almost a decade, I've pushed companies like Apple to include, at that time, just regular AI, because we didn't yet have generative AI, and more recently, generative AI, in the tools they provide to patients, let's say for atrial fibrillation. And I've been critical of them that they've not been willing to take the chance, the risk of the medical legal issue. I understood it from a business standpoint, but as a clinician, I felt we were missing a really great opportunity. The fact that NVIDIA is going to step forward will be interesting to see. So if they're selling the specific tool by name, then they're taking an accountability, at least to the best that I can research so far. But in contrast, if you look at the generative AI overall, we said earlier, this is a combination of everything on the internet, everything in the textbooks and the journals. It's not specific to providing answers. It provides the tool for the patient to enter data and information and get an outcome. And of course, there'll be a disclaimer at the front that it's not able to accomplish it. That would appear to have far less liability for anyone, either for the company or for the clinician who might have suggested it, because it's all dependent upon the patient and the patient's information being put into place and interpreting that information. And I think that for a large number of problems, it either will solve and answer the question, which will take load off of the clinician, who today is getting emails and text messages and other requests for insights, or it will provide the foundation for the doctor-patient conversation and relationship. You may have heard about the KHAN, K-H-A-N Academy in Silicon Valley, which flips on its head education. Rather than going to class, learning a subject and going home and doing homework, the night before the class, you go onto a computer application, you learn a lot of details at your own pace, and class then can focus on deeper conversations, diving into the matter, applications of it. So imagine if the clinician coming to your office, rather than just having a bunch of symptoms, can come there with all the ideas organized and can provide it to you in a way that now allows you to use your judgment and your relationship with the clinic, with the patient, to come up with the best answer. This tool, I do not believe, will replace clinicians. I think it will augment the clinical outcomes that we can achieve.
You know, as humans, we learn a lot from mistakes. Is there any work being done? And I guess medical legally it could be tricky, but just through morbidity and mortality conferences and other reported complications, it'd be fantastic to see how AI could learn from that.
We absolutely need to do studies, and there are quite a number of people who are starting that particular process. Of course, as you might guess, in the early times, they're getting somewhat contradictory answers. Much of that, by the way, being the fact that how the quality of the answer you get is dependent upon the prompt, the information you put in, and there are tools that aren't available. We don't yet have an easy way to download the entire electronic medical record. Your information is scattered across different doctors. They're not interoperable in the medical office level, and they're not all available yet to be downloaded into your application. So it's going to be a time of effort, but I agree with you completely. We should be leading this. We should be having the medical societies create teaching people how to do the prompts and evaluating the outcome. But it's interesting. You may have seen the article in JAMA where they took a bunch of ED doctors and generative AI, and they gave them all the information that the clinician would normally have seeing a patient for the first time in the ER. And the generative AI tool was able to come up with the correct diagnosis 92% of the time. The clinician is only 82% of the time, a significant improvement. And you're well aware of the fact that across the U.S. today, 400,000 people die annually from misdiagnoses. It's not that doctors are not well-trained and highly motivated. It's that they have to cut corners in order to get the work done during the day, or the 250,000 people who die from medical error every year. We know what to do. It's just that we don't have the time to do it. I'm optimistic this technology will both create the time and help us personally to avoid those problems by offering an alternative set of diagnoses, by researching the literature. In the book, ChatGPT MD, I talk about a physician. She's a head and neck surgeon, did a complex procedure in the neck. It It all went beautifully, no complications at all. And then when the patient was going to be extubated, the anesthesiologist noted that the vocal cords, rather than being separated, which is how air passes into the lung, were close together, risking occlusion of the breathing apparatus. If this had been, I'll say, the typical approach, we might have put the patient in the ICU, we might have left them intubated, we might have considered a tracheostomy if the airway could not be maintained. Instead, she went to GPT-4. She put in all the information, and lo and behold, there was a couple of case reports with exactly the same problem due to, in some patients, more rapid diffusion of the local anesthetic, and it provided information that within a half hour, the patients would recover from that and would go home. And that's exactly what happened with her case. No question, we now have an opportunity to diagnose and maximize clinical outcomes.
That's
Wow.
Crazy. Slightly different subject, but I wanted to bring up the idea of big business and how that's going to play into all of this, because specifically, I'm reminded that the introduction and implementation of EMR forced basically everybody into employed practice, and there's very few independent physicians, which we're trying to preserve at Merge Medical. These systems are astronomically expensive. And it seems to me, please correct me if I'm wrong, or I'd love your thoughts. It seems to me that this is going to push further corporatization of medicine. Am I wrong?
You're talking about a very important part that I actually focus on in the book, ChatGPT MD. I divide it into four eras. You know, I talk about the late 20th century. I call it healthcare 1.0. When we saw the introduction of CT, MRI, ultrasound, heart-lung machines, total joint implants, we could go down the whole list of advances that happened during that time period. It was a wonderful era. The consequences of the introduction of technology was leaps forward in terms of improved clinical outcomes, in terms of life expectancy. I'd call healthcare 1.0 a tremendous success. You get to the year 2000, you're highlighting what I think is a major failure in healthcare 2.0. Healthcare 2.0 was the era of the electronic health record. It could have been a really positive tool to help the clinician in the office. It could have provided information on the patient from every one of the clinicians caring for that individual. It's called interoperability, but it didn't do that.
No, it didn't.
That because it was used as a financial tool for billing, for claims, for battling insurance company, for documenting what we do. It was a major error and a failure. 3.0 is the era of the internet. You know, we have things like Expedia. You can plan a trip around the world without a travel agent. It wasn't possible before. You have things like Amazon that can now deliver the goods to your house rather than having to force you to go into stores if you don't have the time to do so. And it gives you information so you can be a more informed consumer. But we didn't use that. And when I look at both of those, to me, anything that slows down the clinician or anything that risks their income stream is not going to be embraced. And again, as we said earlier, not because in any way clinicians are bad. It's just the way human nature is. We're not going to do something that is negative for our families and for ourselves. We're now in healthcare 4.0, which is generative AI. And you're asking the important question, which is who's going to lead the way? Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of data, by the way, you've probably seen it recently, that medical groups and organizations that are led by physicians, by clinicians, have superior outcomes and lower costs compared to ones led by a hospital or insurance administrators. And yet, as you said, over 70% of clinicians today are employed and in that way struggling. You know, it's interesting. I wrote about that way back when and predicted this would happen, that doctors would see these institutions as protecting them. And it did so initially, but I said, you know, once the pressure comes to lower costs, to be more productive, clinicians will have less power and will rue the day they made this choice. And I think we're seeing it now with those institutions. Private equity is the next one, by the way. Same thing's about to happen there. The only solution, I believe, and why this book has five parts. The first three are on ChatGPT itself, the technology, the applications, the opportunities. Part four is on the problems: privacy, security, bias, misinformation. But part five is about leadership. This is the time, I think, for clinicians to come together as clinicians, whether they do it inside a medical society, a physician-run medical group, just across a community, and drive towards taking capitation. Now, why have they not taken capitation? Why have they insisted upon a transactional fee for service rather than a single payment for the totality of care? I think it's because they haven't had the tool to be able to control costs without compromising access or quality. I think we now have it. So I'm optimistic that generative AI offers at least the possibility of preserving the model that, like you, I believe is the right model, which is that physicians and clinicians driving the decision-making processes when it comes to patient care, figuring out how they can do it best. And my belief is that what they have to do is step forward, create leadership structure, use generative AI, and be able to be paid in a different way. And when they do so, I think they can raise quality, improve convenience, and lower cost all at the same time. This is value-based medicine that has been the holy grail of what we've pursued now for decades.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, we had Harvey Castro on just previous to you, and he said that these systems are already being implemented in countries that have far fewer regulation than the United States. Would you agree with that?
Well, I don't think it's a question of the countries. I read a study this week that 40% of clinicians are thinking about using it or are already using it.
Is that right?
Yeah, there's nothing that says you can't, you know, using it is in quotes. What does that mean? So if you're talking about using it for administrative tasks, that's one thing. But helping patients to figure out how they can apply it, telling you, look, here's your problem. I want you to go home and I want you to learn, to become an expert about it, so that when I see you, I can explain in greater detail exactly what we're doing. And what you need to do as the patient in order to improve your outcome. I want you to go home and put your information coming off your glucometer into a generative AI tool. And I will give you some parameters you can provide to the application about when I want to know when things are not going right, so I can make more rapid adjustments. As you well know, we do a poor job. Diabetes in the United States is managed effectively less than half of the time, probably less than a third of the time. Hypertension, the number one cause of strokes, we only manage 55 to 60% of the time. Think about it. You see a clinician in January. They give you a medication. They say, I'll see you back in May. What happens between January and May? Nothing. If you have a monitor, you know your blood pressure, what do you do about it? What about if one measure says 210, but everything else says 130? What about if it's was at 160, now it's at 150? When should you make changes? When should you get expertise? These should be common medical approaches, and this technology can allow that to occur. Yeah, I'm hearing about a huge number of clinicians doing it. It was interesting to me when I was writing the book, a lot of people knew I was writing it because I have my monthly musings that people receive every month, no fee, no subscription cost, no advertising. And I write about it in there that I was working on this particular area. And I've received dozens of emails. This was back 6 months ago. But clinicians tell me, Dr. Pearl, I know you're writing a book about generative AI and healthcare. I want to make sure you know how great it is. I took all of the patients I saw today in the office. I put all their information that they brought to me into an application as though I was the patient. And my gosh, the application came up with the same diagnoses and recommendations that I did. I'm going to be using this in more and more patients to help them become more knowledgeable, to become more empowered before they see me. Yeah, I think this is expanding rapidly across the United States. And I believe it's going to be as common in medical practice as the stethoscope was in the past.
Wow, that's a statement.
But don't you think there are going to be separate solutions for different problems? And almost like when EMRs first came out, I told you I started one back in the early 2000s. I mean, there were some that just didn't do the job. They weren't advanced to the degree that they should have been. And we, like you say, we went the wrong direction with it. The industry did. I mean, I think just me going to ChatGPT to type in something, that doesn't really move the needle. There needs to be something that brings efficiency to that process across a full list of 60 patients in a day or whatever the number is.
The tool that we're talking about right now is not, that's why I differentiate generative AI from narrow AI. In a narrow AI tool, what you're saying is absolutely correct. And that's why it is, you know, advanced a little bit, but not very far. Generative AI is completely different. This is a patient empowerment tool. Now, for the clinician, it's also a tool. You know, if we're stuck with a diagnosis, we can put it into place. It'll give us good information. What does the patient do right now? They go to Google and they click on some links. And they can't do anything with that information. Yeah, I think it actually can empower patients in ways to take better care of themselves. I think they can use it to understand whether the disease is under control, whether they need to connect back with the clinician, what they should be doing. It certainly can help with lifestyle medicine. You know, if you have a patient needing a special diet, they can go there, they can get a shopping list, set of recipes specific to the week. They can get an exercise program. But I think it's much more the ability of the patient to become more involved. I mean, what are doctors often criticizing patients for? They get information in the office about what they should be doing and they don't do it. You know, everyone I know who's a patient wants to be better. It's not that they're not motivated to do so. We just haven't given them the tools to accomplish it. So I think, yes, I think that we need to be doing that, providing the prompts. I'm encouraging the major organizations, the medical societies, the large physician-led medical groups, come up with a patient educational tool, the applications. And in that sense, you're right. You know, the cardiology will be different than orthopedics, and that'll be different than pediatrics. But we can come up with tools to give patients, particularly with some of the newer technologies being introduced. It's what's called plugins. And I like the idea of plugins because it's a visual. It's not really what happens. It's all done by Bluetooth. But you can enter a significant amount of information into the system on a consistent basis, rapidly, conveniently, reliably, and now more recently, memory. So they can retain that across time. I think this is a tool for us as clinicians to now do the thing we should have done decades in the past, rather than signing up with hospitals and selling our souls to private equity. I think we should have come together, collaborated, cooperated, found a different reimbursement mechanism, and been rewarded when we keep people healthy, avoid complications, get better outcomes. I'm absolutely convinced we could restructure medicine far better than the corporate entities. We just let someone else do it. And I'm hoping we're not going to do it this time again.
You're talking our language there.
Yeah. Amen.
Sounds great.
What would you say to, say, a senior in high school that has decided they want to be a doctor? What does their career look like? It'll be 12 years approximately before they're practicing medicine, post-residency. What does it look like 10, 12 years from now in your mind?
And what could they really do to help themselves?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm going to guess that they're going to be pretty sophisticated when it comes to this technology. They probably are very good with a phone right now, and they're going to be very good with generative AI as well. They're probably already using it in their classes and helping them to write their essays and do the studying that they need to do. So I'm less worried about their technical ability. I think that they should be prepared that we're going to have a very different world. It's no longer going to be just the doctor and the patient. It's going to be the dedicated clinician with the empowered patient and generative AI. You know, if you go back and you think about some of the real advances, that's why I divided into healthcare 1.0, 2.0, 3.0, 4.0. How hard was it to teach you how to use CT or MRI? Well, you don't actually use it, but you interpret it. I think we learned how to do that really fast. You know, maybe when it came to something like laparoscopic procedures, we had to take a course. But these very effective tools didn't take us very long to learn. Mm-hmm. And I think the same thing is going to happen here. Mm-hmm. I think it's going to be a core part. On another podcast, I got asked about this, and I said, you know, we all take classes in medical school in physical examination, how to take a history, do a physical exam. We're going to take classes in generative AI. How do you use it to help patients to get better? It's going to be a skill, but it's a skill we can master. It just takes a lot of practice, and that's why medical training is 10 years. We get to practice a little bit in medical school and more in residency and more as we become more senior and become a clinician practicing in the community.
So there's a fear, and I think a reasonable fear, that professions that just think are in jeopardy of being displaced. And that would include physicians that just think, that don't do procedures. So sparing anesthesiologists like myself, Dr. Cole is a hand surgeon, it would seem that those professions I can easily see being very much protected. But specialties such as internal medicine, perhaps not so much. What do you think about that?
Well, first of all, before you're too sanguine, interventional specialties are going to be at risk too. And I don't mean the first 3 to 5 years, but by 10 years, assuming the power continues to increase, it'll be 1,000 times better. And increasingly, as you know, we do a lot of our work without actually touching the patient. We do it by advancing catheters into the coronary arteries. We do it by manipulating robots. There are a lot of different ways that we use a monitor, data coming off of a monitor into a human and then coming out in terms of a movement of a tool or a catheter or some machine or instrument mm-hmm. that actually does the work itself. Mm-hmm. Well, that interface of data coming in and instructions around physical movements, that generative AI is going to be able to do that. I mean, you look today, already you can use a generative AI tool to paint, to create a picture that looks a lot like Rembrandt, even though you never had an art course. You can program a computer, even though you've never taken an IT course. You can write a song like Drake, even though you don't play an instrument. The idea that somehow this application won't be able to take data coming off and response being given and learn from the leading clinicians across the United States, it's going to happen. Now, is 10 years overly optimistic? I don't know. I think it's probably about right. I've actually been, again, surprised at how fast things have moved, faster than even I anticipated. Mm. I thought I was being overly optimistic. I may have been overly conservative. But what mm-hmm. you're really asking, though, is about the cognitive specialties. Mm-hmm. And I believe that, unlike in some other areas, that there is something very vital about the doctor-patient relationship. That will never go away. That the decisions that we make, the simple decisions we make, straightforward. We know exactly what to do. And that's why there are a lot of people with less training who are being able to accomplish this, as well as clinicians in a lot of different areas. But there's a reason why the training process is long, because there is a subtlety when you deal with humans. Because it's not only coming up with the right answer, it's helping people to actually implement that in the way to lead to the best outcomes. And that's where I think we don't do a very good job. That's why I say, you know, we know how to do hypertension. When I was CEO in Kaiser Permanente, we achieved over 90% hypertension control. Now, we did it in a cumbersome way, because it was prior to generative AI. We based it on the computer application that we had, which was interoperative, all 10,000 physicians being able to have access to the same information. We used it from the fact we were an integrated organization and we could make sure the patient got reinforcement at every vision. But 90% is about what we should be at, not 55 or 60%. And figuring out how to make that leap once we create the time for the clinician, I think that's the big opportunity. I don't think generative AI will be any better than we are right now. I think it'll know the right answer, but I don't think it'll be able to move the needle on changing that clinical outcome. But I'm optimistic still that if we give clinicians the time, they will be able to do so. And that generative AI is the tool that can create that for us in a capitated insurance reimbursement methodology.
It's better salesman for the patient's go home instructions and healthcare and execution, I guess, whether that's maybe even AI-generated education videos or whatever it happens to be, I guess.
Well, it's a tool to empower the patient. I think that that's the way to think about this, because right now, take chronic disease. That chronic disease is managed on a calendar basis. If you're doing well, you're doing poorly, I still see you basically every 3 to 4 months. I make an adjustment. Maybe I need to do something else a month from now, and maybe I don't need to do anything else for 9 more months. How do I get the people into my office who are the ones that are going to be the quickest, or not even in my office, with telemedicine? And how do I reassure the other ones there's no need to come in? We don't have that today, but that's what this technology provides. You know, how do I start my conversation with the patient at a far deeper level than today, where the average visit is 17 minutes and I can barely get an update on how they're doing and make a medication change when it's time to see the next individual? I think it's important to see American healthcare as broken, not because of the people providing it, but because of the system around them and the time constraints that are imposed. And as you pointed out, you know, signing up with a corporate entity doesn't make that less. Signing up with private equity probably makes it harder. It's why we have to get it back inside the profession. But I also want to caution people, it won't happen. No matter, even though it's the right thing to do, even though we should do it, we must do it, it won't happen unless we lead the way.
And that's always been the issue, right? Physicians just can't seem to cooperate and hold ourselves together, which is, that's what we're trying to do with this organization. Dr. Pearl, I wanted to come back, and Jeff Cole, I want to hear your thoughts on this too. You, Dr. Pearl, I don't disagree with you whatsoever, but you said that this could potentially reduce, you say, your top three causes of death, heart attack, stroke, cancer, 30-40%, thereby reducing costs. But I mean, maybe this is a dumb question, I'm just missing something, but doesn't it just shift the curve to the right and everybody just live another 5 years, 10 years? So maybe we reduce costs in that 5 year interval, but then ultimately we all die of something. And, or are we predicting that at some point we all just die of old age at home, which is a nice thought, right? I mean, wouldn't we all like that?
Well, so far we all are going to die. So you're absolutely correct there. From a mathematical perspective, which is what I think you're really asking, and the data is interesting to me, that if you look at people who die at various ages, they actually all have a similar, about a 5 year deterioration period. It's just, when does it start? And some people it starts at age 60, some 70, some 80, some not till 90. So the answer is yes, we will still have those deaths, but it'll be put over a bigger denominator, because we'll have more people alive who didn't die. So the total cost goes up, but the cost per person goes down.
Goes down.
And since if you're increasing health, you're also increasing productivity and ability to generate the dollars, whether it's being done through a paid for by a business or by the government. So you're absolutely right. You can come up with a scenario where the best thing we could do to improve the economics of healthcare is let everyone die early. But I don't think that's what any of us want.
That's right.
It does take time for a lot of these things to change. And I think training for certain subspecialties can make adjustments as these things happen. I mean, I think probably cardiovascular surgery might be a good example, where to me, it just seems like there's fewer open heart procedures because of these procedures putting in valves and other.
Oh, for sure.
And so I don't think that's going to put any current cardiovascular surgeons out of work, but it might 5 years from now change the number of people that we need to train. Is there some truth to that?
Oh, absolutely. I you know, again, I'm a specialist. I fix children with a cleft lip and cleft palate. But I think our United States has too many specialists and not enough primary care. And I say that not because specialists aren't working really hard. It's just that we have more specialty problems than we should be having if we had more primary care. Mm-hmm. That's the idea that underlies it. It's not true for every specialty. But let me go back. You know, you would talk. I trained in plastic and reconstructive surgery, did a lot of hand surgery earlier in my career. You know, what percentage of the patients that we take care of with a hand problem leave us and actually fully understand what it is we told them? I think it's less than we believe.
It's low.
So we all have hand therapists, which is a very expensive commodity, very crucial after a tendon repair, where it's very delicate. You've got to make sure you don't rupture the tendon, but you want to maximize the movement. But, you know, it's a pretty expensive way to fill in for information that could be reinforced. So how do we create the tools that allow the patient to learn this at home, to study it again and again and again? How do we create, in essence, the YouTube for the patient about what they should be doing, answering their questions, clarifying the misunderstanding, translating into whatever language they speak, making sure it's at the educational level at which they are? These are the kinds of opportunities that are just sitting right in front of us. And I think we'd get far better results if we had more educated, more empowered, more expert patients. That's at least my belief going into this. If people disagree, I mean, if I could see my patient every single day and advise them and answer their questions, I know I could get better outcomes, but there's no time for that.
Right.
How does technology fill in the gaps? That to me is the way to see it. It's not replacing the doctor. It's filling in, but not filling in an administrative way, filling in a clinical type approach.
Mm-hmm. Well, I could see a time where, you know, there's going to be 5-6 of these big models, but I can see a time not very far from now when we might all have our own model, right? If we think of it this way, this phone we all have has far more computational power than what sent the astronauts to the moon. That wasn't that long ago. And as you spoke of, this rate of change is, it's exponential, right? So is there a time when in our lives where Siri or whatever you're, if you're on Google, I don't know what their bot would be, but I could say to Siri, hey, check my blood pressure, my heart rate, my glucose, you know, maybe the phone scans my retina and I'm feeling like this. And then it, in my lifetime or yours, it spits out what I've got and what I should do.
I think that's 3 to 5 years in the future.
3 to 5 years.
Right around the corner. This NVIDIA AI bot will do a lot of what you're describing right now. The improvements that need to happen are not major breakthroughs. They're just embedding them into the system. The one by Google is called Gemini. Mm-hmm. So there's a variety out there. They're all actually, I'll say, similar, maybe what, you know, 1, 6, or 12 months ahead of the other, but they're all going to get to the same location. But much of it is going to be, how do you program it? You have to say, okay, pretend that you are Dr. Jeff Cole. Mm-hmm. What would you respond to this patient who has this problem? Now, assume you're Dr. Jeff Brown. How would you respond? And that's not just the medical information, which hopefully is going to be somewhat similar, but maybe, you know, one of you is funnier and one of you is more articulate, and you go down the list of opportunities. It actually can duplicate that. And the difference for the most part between the different systems that exist today is not the information. They're all trained on the totality of the internet and a variety of other areas, but it's going to be more about the style. You know, is your style one to be more aggressive with patients, by which I mean encouraging them to do more and more and more earlier in the recovery? Or is your style the more conservative because you're afraid of a complication of something going wrong as a consequence of that? It's more personality-based, actually, than knowledge-based. And I think you may have a choice in the same way you could decide what particular food or wine you like, but it's going to be less about that than the caloric content or particular ingredients that he used to make the food or the drink that you're going to be serving.
And you mentioned it in relation to YouTube earlier, but is there a time when, whether there are companies that do this or we do it on our own, where we just ask the generative AI, please create a 3-minute video about post-op flexor tendon recovery and exercises, and it goes out to find, you know, numerous hand therapy websites, and it assimilates that information and literally generates a patient education video?
It's not a question of time. It's possible today. You have to sort of know a little bit what to do, how to ask the right prompts. As I say, it took me a couple hundred times per chapter as I was writing the book with ChatGPT. No, this is available. It can create movies right now. The limitation is really one of data power, by which I mean that some of the things it can do, it can create 15 seconds, but not 3 minutes. But if it's 15 seconds now, it'll be 30 seconds, then it'll be a minute, then 2 minutes, 4 minutes, 8 minutes, 16 minutes. That's exponential growth. Yeah, no, these are all available right now. And as I say, you know, right now you can go use a generative AI tool and create a movie, make a movie, tell it exactly what you want. It'll take your words and convert it into visual images. We could definitely do that when it comes to post-operative instructions for patients.
So you've mentioned this about four times, but you say prompts. Can you dive into that just a little bit? Is that a personal endeavor learning about generative AI? Is that, where do we go learn about that? Is that in your book? Is that?
Well, there's a lot in my book about it, but prompts are basically what you tell the AI. So if you say, I'm a patient who can't bend their ring finger, it will give you information. If you say, I was washing dishes last night and I had a knife slip and it cut me between my knuckle and my first joint of the finger. And since then, I've been unable to bend it. But if I push on it, I can actually bend it down. It's not that it won't go, it just won't go when I tell it. It's going to tell you, you have a laceration of your tendon in zone two. You need an operative repair. You should have your nerve checked and you should see a hand surgeon. And if you want to know individuals in your area, I'm happy to give you their names with addresses and arranged transportation. Yeah, that's the prompt. What the information you give it, the questions you ask it. You ask it about diabetes, it'll give you a lot of general information. You say, I am a certain age on a certain medication with a certain family history. It will give you a lot more specificity. And when it gives you information back and it's really not your question, you got to learn how to re-ask it and re-ask it. So it's the means of having the conversation. If you think about it, you know, what do we do as clinicians? Patient comes in and gives us a symptom. And then we ask a question. And then they give us an answer. So we ask a different question, another question, and another question. That's how we take a history. Right now, the generative AI tool can't do that for us. So we've got to do it for it. We've got to put in all those answers continually to be able to do it. And when we don't understand something, say, I don't understand that term. Can you rewrite it in a different way? Or can you translate that into a different language? So that's what the prompts are. They're the instructions to the technology. And right now you got to type it in. But as I said, very soon you can just do it by the same way we're speaking right now or the same way you might speak in your clinician's office.
Fantastic.
Yeah, sure is.
Well, I want to be respectful of your time, Dr. Pearl. This has been a fantastic, just a great conversation. Is there anything else that you'd like our viewers to know? Mostly these are physicians and allied health professionals that you'd be speaking with.
The most important thing is to understand that what exists today is not yet ready for prime time, but what is essential right now is to use it and try it. To use it and try it as though you're the clinician, use it and try it as though you're the patient, use it with your patients. This is a learning. Think about getting an iPhone and you've never seen one before, you don't know what to do with it, and there's no instruction manual.
Right.
You would use it. You would try it. You would learn from it. You'd talk to friends. You would find other ways to get information. This is the time to try it. It takes about 10 hours to get really good at generative AI. This is the time for you to try it. Pretend you're a patient. Take the people you saw in your office today, put the information into, and I recommend GPT-4. It's a subscription model. It costs a latte a week. Equivalents, $20 a month. By the way, I'm not financially linked to any of these companies. And as I said, all profits from my book are Doctors Without Borders. But use it, try it, pretend you're a patient, pretend you're yourself seeing an individual. Figure out how you might want to include it in your practice. Don't turn the patient loose yet. You got to wait for a couple more generations, but get ready for the future. And let me reinforce the message that you're doing in your organization. This is the time not to sell your practice to a hospital system or to private equity. This is the time for you and your colleagues to come together and you say, this is a once in a lifetime chance that we have now to change the course of American medicine. We can come together, individuals from different specialties, individuals from different levels of training. We can create an approach that will improve quality, improve clinical outcomes, make care convenient for patients, and lower costs. We know how to do it. We will do it on behalf of our patients. Technology will be the facilitator and the catalyst to allow that to happen. Don't wait another week. Start Monday.
Wow. I could not have said that better myself. Dr. Pearl, author of ChatGPT MD, we thank you for joining us here on the Merge Medical Podcast. I'm Dr. Jeff Brown with my co-host, Dr. Jeff Cole.
Thank you for having me today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Dr. Pearl.